Tonight on PBS News Weekend, as more protesters are arrested, how students and administrators at some colleges are diffusing tensions over pro-Palestinian demonstrations. Then a quickly changing civil war is putting Myanmar on the brink of becoming a failed state. And a new book tells the stories of some of the millions of Americans who've struggled with mental health issues.
Part of the reason why people don't want to talk about these illnesses is they think it's such a reflection on their moral character. When in fact, when you read these, it's clear the illness has taken them hostage, that their behavior is a reflection of their brain illness.
Good evening, I'm John Yang. In the Israel-Hamas war, today was a day of impeded progress. Amid Gaza's worsening humanitarian crisis, Hamas fired rockets at Israeli forces near the main entry point for aid. That led Israel to close the gateway. The Israeli military said three soldiers were killed. The Kerem Shalom crossing has been a lifeline for more than a million displaced Palestinians in need of food, water, and medicine. And in Cairo, the latest round of talks aimed at a hostage release and ceasefire deal has ended as Hamas negotiators went back to Qatar. They're to return to Cairo on Tuesday. Hamas is holding to its position that they would only release hostages in exchange for a permanent ceasefire. That's something Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says is out of the question.
But while Israel has shown willingness, Hamas remains entrenched in its extreme positions. First among them, the demand to remove all our forces from the Gaza Strip, end the war, and leave Hamas in power. The state of Israel cannot accept that.
And the Israeli cabinet voted to shut down Al Jazeera's operations in Israel. Shortly afterward, the main cable provider took it off the air. The Foreign Press Association in Israel called it a dark day for media and democracy. In Kenya, the Interior Ministry said the death toll from flooding and landslides has risen to 228. Torrential rains have battered Kenya for weeks and are forecast to get worse. Homes, roads, and bridges have been destroyed, and more than 200,000 people have been displaced. Ukraine marked its third Orthodox Easter at war with Russia. Ukrainians flocked to churches even as Russia kept up its assault on the Eastern Front. Behind the front line, a chaplain held mass and blessed soldiers who showed the signs of being outgunned and outmanned. In his Easter address, President Volodymyr Zelensky said God has a Ukrainian flag on his shoulder. And the art world has lost one of its great innovators. Frank Stella died of lymphoma yesterday at his New York City home. His paintings and sculptures are distinguished by his use of geometric patterns and shapes. When critics tried to interpret his work, he said, "What you see is what you see," a phrase that became the unofficial motto of the minimalist movement. Frank Stella was 87 years old. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, what a shifting civil war means for the future of Myanmar. And a new book details the personal struggles and triumphs of those living with mental health issues.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
The prevailing images of college protests over the Israel-Hamas war in the past few weeks have been of escalating tensions, students clashing with police and mass arrests. But students and administrators at least six schools from Rhode Island to California have found common ground and negotiated agreements to close tent encampments. Aaron Gretzinger is a reporting fellow at the Chronicle of Higher Education. Aaron, what do these agreements look like? What have schools agreed to do?
Yeah, so at the schools who've made agreements so far, we've seen distinct stipulations, but common themes in each of those agreements. At Northwestern, which made an agreement early last week, we saw several steps toward what students viewed in the groups there as moving toward their major demand of divestment. So there we saw them make agreements to have a committee that will look at divestment. Northwestern agreed to disclose investments to all internal stakeholders, as well as some movement on agreements that have been in the works for longer for students who are Muslim, who are from the Middle East, and are of North African descent. So looking at student centers as well, we've seen similar things in agreements at Brown, who will take a vote on divestment this fall. And overall, I think the main themes to take away here are that these encampments have been really central for administrators who've wanted to focus on de-escalating the situation. That's been the main mantra of these administrators. Students, on the other hand, have really looked at these as key first steps toward their broader demand of divestment.
I was going to ask that. I mean, how meaningful are these concessions? Because they're not divesting. They're going to talk about divesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what a lot of higher ed onlookers have seen in these agreements is that these administrations appear to have taken student demands seriously, but have still fallen short on what other students see as the key purpose of these protests, which is divestment. So there is some question. I think some pro-Palestinian student demonstrators and experts I've talked to as well who study student political activism aren't quite sure how far these agreements will go, if they go as far as some student protesters would hope. There's questions of if this will ultimately result in divestment, and similar universities have taken actions before. Brown and Northwestern have had similar reports and committees studying these issues, but nothing has moved in the past.
And have there been any criticisms or the reactions to this from other student activists and maybe donors and alumni of the schools?
Yeah, so there's definitely been a sense that while some student groups who forge these agreements are declaring victory, and at university administrators as well, some Jewish groups, local, campus, and national, have criticized these agreements, particularly at Northwestern University. We saw some immense backlash there, with three major Jewish groups calling on the president there to resign, characterizing this as a betrayal to these students for failing to enforce their policies there. There's also been a federal discrimination lawsuit filed against Northwestern. So you can see there's sort of the broad spectrum of reactions here, and really gets to the point, I think, of presidents being in hot water in this moment and having to contend with many different stakeholders, sort of pulling everyone in different directions.
I mean, given that the administrators in hot water, what was the motivation for the students to sort of bail them out, to try to get an agreement?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because I've talked to experts who say, you know, students in this regard have a really clear-eyed goal of divestment, and that puts college administrators in a tricky place, because normally they have a playbook to sort of and go into negotiations with students, essentially. Whether it's an identity-based movement, they can turn to certain student affairs programs, or if it's a matter of student-employee relations, they can go to the negotiating table surrounding unionization. But here, when they have such clear-cut demands like divestment, there's not a lot of room for compromise in these students' eyes. And I think that's important to consider in these agreements, where so many students have not even chosen to come to the table, even when their administrators have asked them to.
You talk not going to the table. At Pomona and Yale, students won't talk. Mm-hmm. What are their motivations?
Yes, so there's a sense that, you know, some people have criticized these students that if you want to meet your ultimate goal divestment, you have to come to the table and you have to negotiate. Other experts and students themselves have said, we don't want to stop short of divestment. Until then, there's no point in meeting, right? Until these universities are at least disclosing their investments, taking some action toward that, they don't see a point in meeting. And I think it gets at a broader tension as well. Experts I've spoken to point out that this generation of student activists have grown up in an era full of social justice movements, from Black Lives Matter in 2020, March for Our Lives, climate change, and they've sort of been instilled with a lack of trust in public officials that they see as motivating students to not necessarily come to the table, to not be placated, as that's one of the major criticisms of some pro-Palestinian protesters in this moment, that these agreements are placating students to basically step back, take down these encampments before their ultimate goals are met.
And the schools who wanted to negotiate and reach these agreements, are they in any way pressuring the schools that aren't doing that?
It's a good question. I think it's hard to say how many schools will fall behind these other institutions, because different institutions in this moment are facing different kinds of pressures. For private schools, you know, we have seen an immense amount of donor pressure building up since October 7th. I think public schools have a different sort of obligation. They have a lot of eyes on them from their state legislatures. I think there's also different pressures when it comes to their strict, they have to strictly abide by First Amendment time, place, manner restrictions. And I think a universal pressure in this moment is that it's the end of the semester. And it's kind of a double-edged sword in that sense. It's a really busy time. There's graduation, finals, alumni events that may be pushing some schools to want to pursue action.
Erin Gritzinger, the Chronicle of Higher Education. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Southeast Asian nation of Myanmar is on the brink of becoming a failed state. For 3 years, the nation of 54 million people has been embroiled in an escalating civil war between the military junta and hundreds of pro-democracy militias, ethnic armies, and local defense forces. Civilians are suffering. The United Nations estimates that more than 18.5 million people desperately need humanitarian assistance. Thousands are fleeing the country. A 2021 military coup brought to an abrupt end Myanmar's move toward democracy. The widespread peaceful protests that followed were put down by the junta with a brutal crackdown. Scores of opposition protesters fled the cities for the mountainous jungles that make up much of the country. Pro-democracy militias and armed ethnic groups united with the common goal of overthrowing the junta. Last month, rebel forces took control of a key economic hub that was responsible for $1 billion in trade last year. It's among the latest in a long line of junta defeats over the last 6 months that has left resistance groups in control of a significant part of the country. Earlier, I spoke with Burmese American journalist Amin Tant about the current situation in Myanmar.
Fighting has really escalated in Myanmar since October of 2023, where Myanmar saw large resistance forces really coalesce and form an allyship and launch a coordinated attack against the military on multiple fronts. And since then, major gains were made, especially along the border regions, along major trade routes, and in several cases, trade towns and trade routes were able to be shut down. Although the military has regained control of some of these areas, they have been dramatically weakened.
Who are these groups that are fighting the junta military? Who are they and what do they want?
So there's various groups that are fighting the military. There are what are called ethnic armed organizations, which are made of ethnic groups that were essentially thrown into the country of Myanmar together for the first time through British colonization, but really have a long history of being individual political entities and have been fighting for independence in some cases or more legal rights in other cases. And in some cases, just complete separation from the country of Myanmar proper. And in addition to that, there are also multiple groups that have come to being since the coup, mostly made out of farmers and students and other young people from the ethnic majority group who, since the coup, have turned towards violent revolution as a way to negate the effects of the coup and try to turn the country back towards democracy.
Is there enough common ground among these groups beyond just defeating the military junta that if they were to prevail, they'd be able to establish a government?
Right now, there is a common enemy in the military, but it's unclear that if the military were to fall tomorrow, that these groups would be able to coalesce into a formal government or even some sort of interim government in order to lead the country back into a unified whole. On one hand, there is a civilian shadow government that has formed since the coup, but they don't necessarily have the buy-in of a number of ethnic groups and ethnic organizations that felt that their parties, even when the civilian government was in control, that they really respected and saw various ethnic groups as their equals.
So this fighting has been going on for about 3 years. What's been the effect on the civilian population?
The UN Refugee Agency estimates that over 2.5 million people have now been displaced internally in the country since the beginning of the coup, and over 100,000 people have been displaced into neighboring countries. And that's, of course, not counting nearly 1 million Rohingya refugees who were displaced in previous waves of military violence.
How much support are the displaced people, not only within Myanmar, but who fled Myanmar, how much support are they getting?
So various humanitarian organizations are trying to still function in Myanmar and distribute aid. Unfortunately, in order for them to operate, they are forced to essentially collaborate with the military. And in many cases, the military prevents these organizations from being able to go to certain areas, citing security concerns, to distribute aid. The surrounding countries, Thailand, India, Laos, and China, don't provide very much aid to refugees, if any at all. Thailand does not recognize refugees as a class. The same holds true largely in India as well, where the Modi administration is not happy with the amount of refugees that are coming into the country. Bangladesh has really closed its borders as much as it can to additional refugees from Myanmar. And the border along Laos and China has also been really on guard since COVID and has largely not been trying to accept refugees as well.
The United Nations has described the human rights situation in Myanmar as a never-ending nightmare. Who's committing these? Are these one side or the other that's committing these human rights violations?
So according to monitoring organizations, the vast, vast majority of human rights abuses are being committed by the military. The military is engaging in extrajudicial killings. Over 50,000 people have been killed since the coup, either through torture, extrajudicial killings, airstrikes, war, arson. The military also engages in airstrikes on largely protected places like schools, hospitals, and religious sites. There's a weaponization of arson, burning down of entire villages, rape as a weapon of war. And lately, we're also seeing a lot of forced recruitment by the military. On the other hand, we are also seeing human rights abuses from the resistance side. There have been reports of extrajudicial killings, especially of people who have been accused of being informants for the militaries, or people who are seen as collaborators who are not necessarily armed combatants.
What's the road ahead look like? Is it possible that one side or another could prevail, or is this just going to be a deadlock?
So the fighting has been going on for 3 years, but we've really seen a lot of big moves in the last 6 months. Despite the fact that the conscription law has existed for many years at this point, this is the first time in history that it's being used. And analysts have taken this as a sign that this means that the military is quite desperate to try to fill its ranks, especially as they're starting to lose more and more battles. So what started off as largely, you know, young, untrained people, many of whom grew up in cities and have never touched a weapon, or people who were largely farmers using homemade weapons and commercial drones, have now turned into pretty battle-hardened troops who have gotten their hands onto military weaponry.
Amin Tant, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
For former Congressman Patrick J. Kennedy, advocating for mental health care is part of his family's legacy. His uncle, President John F. Kennedy, signed the bill that established the nation's community-based mental health care system. Ali Rogan sat down with Patrick Kennedy to discuss his new book, which details the mental health struggles of everyday Americans.
The U.S. has long been in a mental health crisis that experts say has only gotten worse in recent years. More than one in five adults deal with mental illness, but there's still a stigma around openly talking about it. Patrick J. Kennedy's new book is called Profiles in Mental Health Courage. The title pays homage to his uncle's book, which profiled American political leaders. This collection of profiles features the mental health journeys of people from around the country. Patrick Kennedy, thank you for being here.
So good to be here.
What made you want to write this book?
Well, I remember when Simone Biles wasn't able to complete the Olympics competition, and everybody was like, why can't you get on that balance beam? And she said, I have to protect my mental health. But really, we don't have a good understanding about what that means, because we don't have anybody who tells their full story. I've told a story, but frankly, we all kind of whitewash it a little bit and make it pretty so that people who are still in the middle of it don't see themselves reflected in any of the public narratives, because let's be honest, these are messy, complex illnesses. And we like finite, very linear descriptions. And for us as a nation, we know all the statistics are horrendous. Suicide going up, overdose going up. But what we don't have is a sense of what does this really mean? Like in real people's lives, how do they navigate trying to get insurance coverage? How do they navigate getting good coverage in terms of delivery of evidence-based treatment, which many people don't receive? And then how do they navigate personal relationships? because these are not illnesses in a vacuum. They involve the whole family. And often those stories get left out. We just hear from the first person narrative, this is what happened to me, as if their family was not part of it. So I interviewed the therapist, family members, friends. And it's interesting that that provides a much more realistic portrayal of what they're really going through than the one we often like to tell.
You address a lot of misconceptions in the book. What do you think are some of the biggest, most persistent misconceptions about mental health?
Well, the beauty about these stories is that by the end of reading them, people will get a sense of the person and their illness. Mm. Part of the reason why people don't want to talk about these illnesses is they think it's such a reflection on their moral character, when in fact, when you read these, it's clear the illness has taken them hostage, that their behavior is a reflection of their brain illness. And that's a piece that we really haven't fleshed out because people still, you know, say that that's your moral failing, that you've acted in such a way. When you read these stories, you get a very clear sense, well, no, this is this person, and then this is their illness. And those that are already in the middle of it will feel less alone because they'll read stories that they can identify with. We have a very diverse set of profiles who also have a very diverse set of diagnoses. But I think from all of it, you will see people need, you know, evidence-based treatment for therapy, talk therapy, medicine, and social supports, housing, supportive employment. You can't just do one piece of this and expect the whole thing to work out. Unfortunately, given our medical system and what we pay for, we often pay for just one leg of the stool. And no wonder it falls down. And no wonder we as a nation are wondering, we spend all this money on mental health, but what's it getting us? We're not paying for what we need to pay for. If we did, we would be getting results. Not only because we would screen people earlier, which is what we do for cancer and cardiovascular disease and diabetes, we would be treating them earlier too, which would mean they'd have a better chance of recovering. When people read these stories, they'll have the sense we need as a nation go further upstream. If we have a conversation earlier about this because we're not so filled with shame, we're going to be able to help people earlier in the process of their suffering because we're not going to say, oh, that's something I shouldn't talk about because it's intruding on their personal territory. We'll have that conversation because we want to save each other's lives. And at the end of the day, more people will end up surviving.
One of the things you write about a lot in the book in terms of your own story and the others that you share is the connection between mental health and addiction. And so frequently they're treated as two completely separate things. Why was that important to make that point throughout the book?
Well, obviously we've divvied up brain illnesses as if they're all separate diagnoses. Mm. When it's the brain, the brain, the brain. And obviously you need to treat both kind of concurrently if you're going to get the best results. And in the advocacy world, we need to stop this siloing. We all want the same things. And so we need to create a new political movement that's much more sophisticated and has the power that really the numbers reflect. We are the biggest special interest group, or we could be, if we were organized. And as a former elected official, if I knew this many people in my district cared about this issue, which I can't get now, there's no listserv like there is for the environment or for organized labor or any other issue, I can't know how many people in my district really will vote differently based upon whether I adhere to their stated set of priorities. So in the back of this book, I have a QR code to our Alignment for Progress. The concept is we want to align the financial incentives so that we provide housing, supports, medication, talk therapy, and we get the best results. Our goal is 90% screened, 90% given evidence-based treatment, and 90% having supportive recovery. That should be our goal as a country. Unfortunately, we don't have a vision that unites us. But we have to build on these stories in order to create that vision.
Yeah, and these stories really illustrate that vision that you're talking about. Patrick Kennedy, author of the new book, Profiles in Mental Health Courage, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that is PBS News Weekend for this Sunday. On Monday's PBS NewsHour, WNBA star Brittany Griner opens up about her 10 months in a Russian prison and her return home. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. Have a good week.